Jerry Bader Show, 936. Take a few more calls on this. 406-1360. 888-455-1360. The research community, the medical research community, is split on the work led by a researcher at Madison to replicate to 97% the Spanish flu virus that killed 50 million people in 1918. Is this recklessly and needlessly dangerous, or does it serve a purpose in helping us to deal with future epidemics and pandemics? Here's a piece from The Guardian that sets the argument. There may be a fatal tumor in your brain. The only way we'll know is if I cut it open, but there's a chance that might kill you. Should I go ahead? Okay. There may be a fatal tumor in your brain. Then again, there may not. And you know what? With all of our 21st century diagnostic tools, we just can't tell unless we open your skull. So, would you take the chance? Okay, they're not going to know for sure unless they actually open up and check my brain. But that opening of my skull could kill me, only to find out I don't have a tumor. The diagnostic tools that we have suggest you might have a tumor, and if it's what we think it is, it'll kill you. But we can't know that until we open you up. But opening you up might kill you. So, Jason, what would you do? Would you roll the dice and take your chances and not have them open you up? You'd want to hear percentages, right? What are the odds that I have this? You'd want another MRI? They've done everything they could do. You have checked with every... They did the dye test. They did everything. They simply cannot be conclusive. They did a CAT scan. They had someone with a crystal ball examine you. They've done everything. Okay. We've just been confronted with a question a bit like this by scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They insist the only way to guard against the outbreak of a deadly flu epidemic like the Spanish flu of 1918 is to create viruses very similar to those responsible. Not to study them in the wild, mind you, but to actively engineer from bird flu genes a strain that can pass in airborne droplets from one animal or perhaps species to another. Sure, it's dangerous. But what about the risk of doing nothing? So, should they go ahead? Not according to Sir Robert May, one of the world's most respected epidemiologists. Publicly, he has called the work absolutely crazy. And given May's reputation for directness and his private opinion is likely to be less polite. He's not alone. Other researchers have challenged the claims of the Wisconsin team that their work is the only way to find out how to combat a lethal flu outbreak effectively and that the experiments were deemed necessary and safe by experts. May even suggest the team effectively hoodwinked the U.S. National Institute of Health into gaining approval and funding. Research on pathogens, particularly viruses, has become increasingly disputatious over the past decade. I don't know if I'm familiar with that word. In 2000, and then they go on. Research often carries risks, whether of intentional misuse or accidents. The discovery of nuclear energy in the early 20th century and of how to release it through nuclear fission in 1938 were arguably examples of pure research with perilous applications. The argument is here, is the return on investment worth the risk? I don't know. I'm not an epidemiologist. But there are those who say this risk just doesn't yield that kind of reward. Creating something that you know could create a pandemic because it might help you prevent one? Of course, you understand. I mean, this all they thought Pasteur was nuts with the rabies vaccine. Researchers who ended up being proven right over time have been called insane before. Robert on the road. Robert, hi, you're on the Jerry Bader Show.
Jerry, the point that you brought up about weaponization, from everything, I'm in the medical field, and a lot of what I've read is people that deal in viruses deal for two reasons. One is to weaponize them. The other one is to combat pandemic diseases and things like that. There are enough viruses that they could work on. He does not have to create one, because that's always the possibility of an escape. If it goes from casual contact to airborne, viruses mutate. The common cold that we have mutates every year. The flu mutates every year. If they get a mutation where they lose track of this, it could be up to, if you look at the science fiction way of looking at that, literally with jet airplane travel, you can have a pandemic that spreads around the world and can wipe out to 7% of the population within months. So it's unbelievably stupid and dangerous for this guy to do that. The only reason you would do that is to get government contracts for weaponization. That's the only thing I can think of.
Okay, if you are right, let's accept your point of view on that for sake of discussion. Then who's really the culprit here? Is he or those who sanctioned the research?
Those that sanctioned the research, because there are enough viruses that they can experiment on. They don't have to recreate a deadly virus. And it's research is driven by dollars. That's all there is. You know, when they talk about pure research anymore, there is no such thing as pure research. Everybody in the college system is working for somebody. Everything they're gonna do is gonna get patented and sold somewhere.
Thanks a lot for the call. I want to read an email from a friend. By the way, it's not my analogy. It's from The Guardian. The analogy with the brain surgery. Jerry, your analogy, again, it's not mine, is slightly flawed. The option isn't that the brain surgery may kill you. It is that it might possibly kill you and your family. To generate viruses only to test and study them is scary. I agree. But is it ever necessary? I think that's the larger ethical question here. Is the risk of doing this ever worth the reward? I don't know. I'll say this. I am not at all put at ease by the safeguards, although we have protocols that this could never get out. Crapola. I'm afraid I simply don't believe that. And there is too much money involved for someone to be paid to do something inappropriate with it. People can be bought, you know. Again, the key question here, should we do something just because we can, scientifically? More and more and more in the last 50 years, particularly in the medical field, it seems that we have decided to do that. As research develops new techniques, well, what if we try this? Now, it's easy to say, well, no, that's reckless. But that is, quite frankly, that is critical to discovery. Pure human curiosity. My position on this is those who oversee it, the National Institute of Health and others, and the university itself, have a responsibility to make a judgment call here. And I understand that you don't want to stifle research. But somebody has to be the cop. Somebody has to be the adult in the room. Somebody has to say, you know, no, that's a step too far. Was this a step too far? My inclination is, in listening to the other epidemiologists and others around the world, I'm not hearing anything that convinces me that it was worth the risk. But I think it's possible that there would be a situation where this is worth the risk. But I don't know that that situation exists. And I'm having a hard time imagining what it would be. That we would be willing to risk something that could unleash a pandemic that would kill tens of millions. Well, Jason pulls one out of the blue, but it makes the point. What if the strand of the flu leads to a cure for autism? What if it doesn't? Okay. I don't know. I don't think viruses work that way, but I get your point. That's rolling the dice. With absolutely no evidence to suggest it's going to do anything miraculous, should he have done this? Without any evidence it's going to do something miraculous, I don't think it's worth the risk, or likely isn't worth the risk. But, unlike some people who've called in, I think it can be worth the risk. That's where I disagree, Jason. Jason says that nothing would ever happen. Okay, you're right. Unbridled risk has led to reward. Jason is right about that. But this is a really great risk. And when the risk is this high, you have to wonder if it is, it just to me, and I guess what's particularly scary here, is you have epidemiologists, you have others who think this guy's nuts. And apparently this type of edgy research is something he's done before. Edgy's not even the right word. I'm not dismissing it out of hand because I don't know. From what I'm hearing, I don't think it's worth the risk, although I think this type of research, there might be circumstances where it is. I'm just, what I'm hearing, I don't think this is one. Jan in Green Bay. Jan, go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I would like to give an instance of something that was a failure that turned out. Do you ever use sticky notes, Jerry?
Right, and I know they were in, I can't remember what it was intended for, but it was something else.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a good adhesive, and it flunked. And so I'm reminded of the axiom of Bucky Fuller saying that there are no failures, only unexpected results.
I agree with that, but what was the downside if the adhesive didn't work the way it was supposed to, Jan? What was the danger?
Exactly.
See, that's the problem.
That was totally a physical, chemical sort of thing. It's not a human problem.
Thanks a lot for the call. That's the issue. Aluminum foil, I don't remember what they were shooting for, but it was something different as well. So this is very different from that. John and Stevens Point. John, you get the last word on this. Go ahead. John? Well, John doesn't get the last word because... Okay. Go ahead, John. John, you there?
I was going to say that I think you're underweighing the risk because with the amount of travel people can do, the congestion of cities and so forth, where back in 1918 it was 50 million people, we could be looking at billions.
No doubt about it that today, if this thing gets out into the general population, hundreds of millions, if not billions. I absolutely agree on that. I don't think, and I am seeing nothing to suggest, John, that the risk is worth, there's just no reward there. But thanks a lot for the call. What I am saying is, I can't think of a specific one, but I think it's possible there might be a situation where it would be worth the risk. It is 9:50. There's become a ritual around the Bader House. So what does the scale say today? That's because my wife is now on Proactive Weight Loss Solutions, and we don't see each other much in the morning anymore, so I haven't had a chance to ask. I think she's in the neighborhood of about 25-plus pounds lost, and she continues to have success. I am now trying to transition to where I'm going to be for the rest of my life after having lost about 65 to 68 pounds. It's bouncing around a little bit because I have started adding foods back. That's one of the big questions I got. Well, okay, Jerry, you've lost a lot of weight. Now what? Well, there is a plan for that. Dr. Litwin does help you transition back to a life where you add foods, but you keep the weight off. Now, nothing in life is guaranteed, but I've tried and failed before, and I feel comfortable that this is my best chance of keeping this weight off, leading a very active lifestyle now, jogging, resistance exercise, and my wife is anxiously looking forward to that stage as well, and Dr. Litwin will be there for her. He was there for me. He can be there for you. Call 920-268-1386, 920-268-1386. 1386.
The Jerry Bader Show.